You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 1st of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Rome's voters prepare to reconsider their choice of mayor. Australia thinks about allowing its own citizens to visit, possibly. And one Japanese prefecture's intriguing response to marauding bears. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, which means it's our weekly in-house daily, and the two members of staff who least convincingly feigned sudden illness this week were Tom Edwards and Chiara Ramella. They'll be here to discuss the day's big stories and the best means of raising public awareness around the dangers of bear attack, and our Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson reflects on an eventful week in Japan. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Monocle's culture editor Chiara Ramella and Monocle's head of radio Tom Edwards. Hello.
Good evening, Andrew. Can I be the first to say I resent your residual joke that I'm in any way reluctant to be here? I'm positively brimming with energy. I'm pulling at the reins to get cracking into today's show.
I think we all know that none of that is true. I did want to ask you in this light introductory banter section of the program to cunningly foreshadow the last item about bear attacks. What is the largest or most terrifying wild animal either of you have ever been attacked, pursued or menaced by?
Chiara, do you want to field this one first of all?
I'm thinking. The only thing I can think of right now is an encounter with a pack of stray dogs in Bangkok, which sounds quite exotic. I mean, I escaped unscathed.
Okay.
They didn't pursue me. It was still relatively scary.
When you said they didn't pursue you, so basically there was just a pack of stray dogs just there.
But they were looking at me with real evil eyes.
They looked at you. So okay, low bar there from Chiara, Tom. Can you clear that? Can you do better than having once been stared at by some dogs?
I'll see that and raise it. I was menaced by a macaque.
Amazing.
Hmm. And I, to be honest, the scars are still quite profound, so I'd like to move on.
But I am reminded from the production booth that Carlotta, who is overseeing this program, was quite recently maimed by a fish.
Maimed by
When I say maimed, she was bitten in extremely unimpressive fashion by a brim, was it? It was a brim, she nodded.
Nibbled by a stickleback. I'd say my macaque wins the day. What about you, Andrew? An encounter with a funnel web back home in the motherland?
I have mercifully never been bitten by a funnel web spider, which is part of the reason I'm sitting here. I do have a scar on my left hand, which listeners cannot see, that was put there by a kookaburra.
Oh, that's good.
So that's quite. I think I've won
the bird rather than an item of cricketing sportswear.
I've got a few scars from things branded kookaburra rather than actual kookaburras. But anyway, I've won. We should just close the show right there.
He always sets these things up for himself. No other reason for this.
How are you just now figuring this out, Chiara?
Can I say, Andrew, though, the only real way to resolve this is for you to bring in a kookaburra. I'll source
we'll
a macaque.
We'll all endure it.
And we'll let them go at it right here in Midori House. Then we'll see who's winning.
And then we will all get arrested. Anyway, let us move along to the day's actual news agenda. Rome will vote on Sunday and Monday in a mayoral election. Advance reports from the campaign trail do not suggest a happy citizenry. The incumbent, Virginia Raggi, won big in 2016, surfing the wave of enthusiasm for the impish yahoos of the five-star movement which she represents. However, Romans have since become very much not the first people in human history to have learned the hard way that self-styled outsider revolutionaries are often rather better at, certainly more interested in, making grand proclamations and rebellious gestures than they are in getting the bins collected. Chiara, how bad have things got?
Quite bad. I mean, I think this is really interesting because in Italy, like many other countries, the election of the mayor of the capital city is quite indicative of the political situation in the country. But I think it's particularly because the issues of Rome are so kind of mundane that the shortcomings of the movement for stars have really kind of come to light. And that has influenced their standing politically as well. So I think the fact that they had Virginia Raggi as the mayor of Rome has truly really affected, I think, their standing kind of nationally as well. Because we've all seen stories, you know, these have made headlines internationally. Buses self-combusting on the, streets.
That is a bad look.
It's really quite bad. You know, rubbish on the street with boars coming and eating it, seagulls. And she has reportedly, you know, tried or proposed solutions for a number of kind of municipal problems that have elicited quite a lot of hilarity. She said that she was going to get the sheep out to try and kind of mow the lawn on certain parks. She said that she was going to get some bees to improve pollution. And people were like, yes, but there's a pile of rubbish outside. Could we just please sort that out?
Would the sheep not fight with the boars? Would that be a problem?
That would be pretty one-sided, wouldn't it?
That just all feels like
we're going very animal-themed on this.
Cause more problems than it solves. Tom, this does feel like something of a parable for our times, not just in Italy, but all over the democratic world, where people have decided, like, what we need is outsiders, an end to career politicians, and then it turns out that people who have no experience of politics turn out to be not actually terribly good at governing, if only there'd been some way to see that coming.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And it's funny, you know, after the German elections, we said, oh, how boring again, a narrow thing, and it'll take them 160 days to do a coalition. What we would not all give for such a predictable political system. I think you're exactly correct. And it's funny, I guess, you know, City Hall, it's not always going to make a massive difference potentially in terms of informing the wider political landscape. But as Chiara has, I think, explained very well, it's really highlighted the necessity of allowing some of these blowhards to have a bash and then reveal to the world exactly how competent, how incompetent they are. Much as we should allow bad ideas out there precisely to be contested and replaced with better ideas, we should allow these lunatics a go. I know it's hard for a great city like Rome to go through this, but it does serve a broader purpose. The funny thing that it also reminds me of, Andrew, is, you know, you said, you know, empty the trash. I did a quick bit of research and there are, you know, there's rubbish piling up in the streets. It reminded me of being right here in London. We've got cars queuing at petrol station forecourts, an energy crisis. It makes me think of the winter of discontent and, you know, the three-day week and the dark old days of the 70s. I don't know if it is as evocative of bad past times in Italy, but it just makes you realise that for all the talk of progress and all the rest of it, we're never that far away from going back to some pretty grim old times.
Chiara, is there any evidence nationally, do you think, in Italy that the whole five-star joke is beginning to wear a bit thin?
I think that has been happening quite noticeably over the past few years. I mean, Conte, who was the PM until not long ago, was very kind of appreciated in his handling of the pandemic. But ever since he left, and I think ever since Draghi became the new PM. But even before that, the Movement for Five Stars was going through quite a steady decline. And I think what, you know, to the point that Tom was making, you know, yeah, let them have a go and show how incompetent they are. Yes, but unfortunately, in Italy, this hasn't kind of resulted in a kind of rosy picture where we all realise that the experts should really be running the show and everything should go back to nice old boring, which it never was in Italy anyway. Because I don't think I've ever said that about Italy in my life. But actually, nowadays, the people who are kind of hoovering up the votes are the far right, you know, parties. Lega is still enjoying a lot of popularity. Interestingly, Fratelli d'Italia, which are the proper far right, you know, the kind of really, I guess, the AFDs of Italy, you know, they are the ones who have enjoyed, with Giorgia Meloni, a huge step up in consensus. And, you know, the PD, the centre-left party, is basically now kind of neck and neck with all these, what would have been considered fringe far right parties, are now some of the major actors in Italian politics. So the moment that Movement 5 Stars loses consensus, those votes end up shifting into more populist camps, but perhaps those that don't even have a little bit of a kind of left-leaning sympathy. No, they're far-right, proper kind of populist parties.
Tom, final quick thought on this. Is there any hope, do you think, that we as a species are going to once and for all permanently learn the lesson about electing, you know, maverick outsider candidates who don't actually know what they're doing?
Well, it doesn't sound like it. And I would apologise for my flippant remarks, because clearly, you know, the unforeseen consequence of letting some lunatics take over the asylum is if then the public take a step back and say, you know, you got any real maniacs out there? That's obviously much, much worse. I don't know, Andrew, you tell me. Is Australia in the mood to do away with, you know, popular right-wingers and get a tedious middle-of-the-road technocrat in? I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, but Australia, we have a couple of things which mitigate, I think, he said, at the risk of tempting fate, against sort of the lunatics taking over the asylum, as you so evocatively put it. One is that our politics generally is fairly staid and is fairly conservative. But also, I have banged this drum on this show before. I do think the compulsory vote is a huge, huge buttress against outsider insurgencies, because the collective wisdom, such as it is usually somewhere centre groundish and basically fundamentally reasonable. It's very, very. We occasionally get, you know, dingbat candidates elected to the federal senate, where the threshold for election is quite low, but an equivalent to five star is almost literally unimaginable in Australia, I think.
I'd go along with that, and I think that's the difference between the rhetoric about your vote counting. I think legislate, literally make it count, and then people treat it with a bit more respect. Or at least that does seem to be the case in Australia.
Well, on the subject of my homeland, to the great relief of Australians overseas, and probably many of my colleagues, Australia is to tentatively begin allowing its citizens to come back. Australia took one of the hardest lines against COVID-19, locking out not only the world at large, but many thousands of its own citizens, your narrator included. It also prevented its people from leaving. From November, however, Australians will be able to travel once their state's vaccination rate reaches 80%, that's travel as in leave the country, and Australians abroad will be able to return if fully vaccinated and willing to spend 7 solid days at home with their relatives. But actually, I should, in the interests of balance, assume that their relatives are willing to spend 7 solid days at home with them. I did want to ask you both first how weird it seems to you the line Australia has taken. And we must also plug the still on the shelves current issue of Monocle magazine, in which I discuss this very thing with a stellar panel of the broadcaster Yasmin Abdul-Majid, the broadcaster Stan Grant, and our former Foreign Minister Bob Carr.
Well, I think that it's really interesting that Australia is doing this, because I do think that at the moment you can see, you know, a very stark picture globally of countries that have decided to just do away with a lot of the restrictions and basically just push ahead with this idea of, you know, going back to normal or whatever that might be. And then a group of nations that are kind of holding on to the closed borders elimination strategy. And I think Australia's move in this respect is very interesting, because it might pave the way for a new possibility, because a lot of the other countries that are still holding on to the idea of elimination strategy may now have a new example to follow. It's kind of a third way that perhaps may help shift the narrative globally as well.
Andrew, I wondered if I may inelegantly paraphrase the stand first of aforementioned magazine
Please
article
do.
And sort of turn the tables and ask you the question, because I think what's interesting is Australia, like other nations, some of its near neighbours included, moved early, very decisive, great achievements, tackled this thing head on, made some tough decisions,
Indeed.
And seemed to bring their population along with them. Amazing. But then over 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, really allowed all of that achievement to unravel in a fairly spectacular, to my mind, way. Do those two achievements, the one so impressive, the one really rather disappointing, tell us all we need to know about, I don't know, the mindset of your fellow countrymen?
Yes and no. We do talk about this a bit in that panel discussion, which I do obviously recommend. I mean, Bob Carr, as the one among us in that panel who has some experience of actually having run a government, because prior to being foreign minister, he was premier of New South Wales for many years, was very careful to make it clear that none of this is an exact science. You know, political leadership never is. You're trying to react to a developing situation. Had the Delta variant not been a thing, Australia's approach might now still look like an absolute model that the rest of the world, where it was possible, should have followed. So there is that. But I think, and this did come up in the conversation, that it's brought out some not entirely admirable aspects, I think, of Australia. And it did occur to me when I was putting together the research for this thing that, yeah, when you think about it, the idea of Australia as this outgoing, gregarious nation of the world, it's actually pretty recent. This is really only from the 1980s onwards, when we had a very outward-looking internationalist Labour government led by Bob Hawke and then Paul Keating, the advent of really quite affordable international travel, because flying anywhere from Australia is no small undertaking, and it's not a cheap undertaking. It's not like we can go to Paris or Rome or Dublin for the weekend. Well, we could, but it would be insane. But obviously, before that, you have a couple of hundred years since the British invasion of the continent and European settlement of, just by necessity of where we are in the world, that we were a remote, insular, cloistered, self-sufficient and somewhat paranoid nation. And obviously before that, there are immemorial centuries where nobody even knew Australia was there, apart from, obviously, the original inhabitants. So I did find myself wondering, were the last 30 years a blip? You know, under the pressure of this thing, have we kind of reverted to type and just sort of decided, what do we need the rest of the world for?
Because it does seem that it was much closer to the surface than many thought. I wonder, do you think it was closer to the surface than you would have credited, precisely because you had spent the best part of whatever 25, 30 years not in the country? Does that in some way not blind you, but I don't know, it kind of slightly misleads you about what the real status might be under the surface?
I was surprised very much by aspects of it. I was very surprised at the, as far as I could tell, the near total indifference to the fact that thousands of Australian citizens were stranded overseas. And for me, I always want to make this clear, for me it has been merely inconvenient. You know, I live here, I work here, this is where my life is. I didn't enjoy not being able to go back to Australia at Christmas, as I usually do, but, you know, really, grand scheme of things, no big deal. There are people who've been locked out of Australia who live there. That's where their homes and their jobs and their families are, but because they happened to be out of the country when the pandemic struck, it was just, sorry, tough luck. I never understood that. I never understood why there was so little objection to that at home. It was very odd.
Well, I was thinking about that because I think we do have the perspective of the outsiders here. You know, all the Australians and the Kiwis I know are all people who live abroad. And so our perspective on this issue is very much of those who have been locked out and therefore are very, very upset about the borders having been shut for such a long time. But is the sense that a few thousand citizens being stranded abroad isn't that much in the grand scheme of things, that people back home are fairly happy that no one's been able to come in? And are they unbothered about opening to tourism, or even perhaps even a bit reticent and scared about things going back to borders being open?
I think there's, I mean, this comes up in the chat as well, and Bob Carr and Stan Grant in particular talk about this very eloquently. There's always been, I think it's actually quite common among island nations generally. I think Britain has elements of this as well. There's the fear of what is over the water, and Australia certainly has historically had a big dose of that. I mean, you could possibly argue that there's an amount of projection there because, of course, modern Australia was literally founded by some malign force coming from overseas and ruining everything for the people who lived there. That's possibly a slightly glib analysis, but I do think, regrettably, that, yeah, I think there's a not small part of Australia that's actually not all that fast.
I thought it was funny. I don't want to give all the great grade A material from this article away over the airwaves, but is it Yasmin who said in the piece that Australia in this instance is a bit like a teenager?
Yeah.
I don't want anyone to tell them what to do, but actually they're not really as independent as they'd like to let on. I thought that was a pretty smart analogy.
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised by some of what Bob had to say on that front as well, and I'm faintly surprised that he hasn't gotten into more trouble for it, by which I think we've learned there's not many Monocle readers at some of Australia's more excitable tabloid newspapers. Tom Edwards and Chiara Ramella, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We will have more from our panel, including the thing about bear attacks, after this.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Since 1890, Allianz has stood side by side with people as they overcame the impossible. Allianz has always been an innovator. Allianz secures people's future, giving them confidence in tomorrow. Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side, to provide solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Allianz. Confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Miller. Still with me are our guests Chiara Ramella and Tom Edwards. But first, it was quite an eventful week for the people of Japan, notwithstanding the bear attacks. There's a brand new prime minister in power, an earthquake hit, and some COVID restrictions were lifted. Our bureau chief in Tokyo, Fiona Wilson, sent us this report.
At 5:37 p.m. yesterday, a magnitude 6.1 earthquake struck Japan. Although the epicenter was 400 kilometres below the Sea of Japan, it was enough to give us a jolt in Monocle's Tokyo Bureau. That it came shortly after the election of the man who will on Monday almost certainly be declared Japan's new Prime Minister prompted many to run with talk of political earthquakes. In reality, the metaphor doesn't quite work, since 64-year-old Fumio Kishida, the man who was elected as new leader of the Liberal Democratic Party, is generally seen as anything but an earthshaker.
Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, has selected Fumio Kishida as the next prime minister. Polls show he is not popular with the public, but the fact is that largely doesn't matter too much given the dominance of the LDP since 1955.
He's routinely described as a safe pair of hands, a realist, and less flatteringly as bland and uncharismatic. Kishida was not the popular favourite. If the public had been asked, they'd have voted for Taro Kono, the headline-grabbing MP with the biggest Twitter following in Japanese politics and a knack for upsetting the establishment.
If you look around the region, many countries have been increasing their defense spending, and it's been increasing quite drastically. But for the last just about 20 years, Japan's defense spending is just about a flat. People talk about...
Still, the public weren't asked, and when it came to it, the parliamentary party voted for Kishida. A long-serving foreign minister, he navigated some tricky diplomatic moments, which should stand him in good stead with a more assertive China and with North Korean missiles inching ever closer. Nepotism still rules in Japanese politics, and Kishida is no exception. A third-generation politician, he was born in Tokyo and spent several years as a child in New York. He says the racism he experienced there made him determined to fight for fairness. His electoral district is Hiroshima. As foreign minister, he welcomed Barack Obama to the city, on which America had dropped an atomic bomb in 1945. Obama was the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima.
71 years ago, on a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky. And the world was changed.
In baseball, Kishida naturally supports the Hiroshima Cubs. And celebrated his victory last night with one of Hiroshima's favourite dishes, okonomiyaki, as made by his wife Yuko. Japanese Twitter today was full of photos of okonomiyaki, which is one of Japan's less photogenic dishes. A savoury pancake stuffed with cabbage, seafood and meat and slathered in a thick brown sauce. Kishida has been waiting in the wings a long time. He lost out to Yoshihide Suga in the last LDP presidential race, and today many are saying that Kishida will have to repay the political overlords of the LDP for his victory by giving cabinet seats to their preferred candidates. Kishida is an old-school moderate conservative who has pledged to help those who've been left behind by economic growth. He has said he wants to help families with young children and raise wages for health workers. In foreign policy terms, he's a dove, not a hawk. But he has said that he will take a firm stance on China. Speaking with more urgency than we're used to seeing, Kishida yesterday also acknowledged that people have lost faith in politics. How he plans to fix that is less clear. His most pressing job is to steer the party, which has enjoyed almost uninterrupted dominance in post-war Japan, through a general election in November. Kishida was always seen as the continuity choice, but he seems to be keen to shake off his dowdy image. His tenure should get off to a good start. The state of emergency that currently covers Tokyo and 18 other prefectures comes to an end today. And after the earthquake, it seems that Mother Nature hasn't finished yet, as Tokyo braces itself for a typhoon tomorrow. For Monocle in Tokyo, I'm Fiona Wilson.
Thank you, Fiona. You are listening to The Daily Stir with me, Akiara Ramella and Tom Edwards. And now, it may seem, for obvious enough reasons, that roughly the last thing British school kids need right now is more time out of the classroom. However, one advisor to the UK's government has cooked up a scheme which will require and or enable exactly that. Sir Michael Barber, former head of Tony Blair's delivery unit, has been undertaking a post-COVID review of Boris Johnson's government. He has suggested giving children 10 days out of the school year in which to tick off a bucket list of cultural experiences. Kiara, in general, as our culture editor, this is very much your beat. What do you think of this?
Well, I agree that children should be taken to cultural sites. I think as an Italian kid, I almost had a bit too many of those. I forget how many times I've been to the Egyptian Museum in Turin and to countless ruins of civilizations. Not even sure which ones. But I do think that it's important. I mean, I wrote a story for the Monocle Minute just this week, which is about the V&A's Museum of Childhood here in London rebranding into the Young V&A. And, you know, Tom and I had a conversation about this because his children love the place. He loves the place. And it's a museum that at the moment is dedicated to, I guess, like the social history of childhood. And it's going to change, hopefully, into this place that's actually aimed at children, when children can go and engage with art in a way that is framed for them. And so the whole museum is really aimed at them, and it's not just like an afterthought where you have a museum that you think might be very boring for the children, so you have to come up with a few screens so they can push some buttons or like some costumes they can put on at the end of the visit. So I do think that we are at a point where we really do need to think about what reaching out for a new demographics actually means, because a lot of the conversation and a lot of the institutions often revolves around digital and how willing you are to go into digital to attract this new generation that we imagine fully enamored and enraptured by screens. Again, it's another conversation I had recently, which I think is supremely interesting. It was with the editor of Internazionale Kids, which is the kids' version of Internazionale, a magazine in Italy that collects the most interesting international articles from publications around the world and then collects them into this nice, neat weekly magazine, I should say. And they've created a version for kids which does not talk down on them at all, is about international affairs. The Internazionale Kids organised a festival with talks for kids, and kids went and engaged, and they like getting the print magazine through the post. All of this to say that I think that talking down to kids and expecting they won't be interested in things is, I think, more of a sign of shortcomings from the point of view of the parents or of the educators who can't be bothered to do it and to actually pass on this knowledge in a way that is interesting and directed at the kids. So if the trips to the cultural bucket list can actually be an occasion to talk directly at the kids, why not? I can only welcome them.
Tom, would you have welcomed an initiative such as this when you were at school? Would it have saved you having to bunk off to go to the opera?
How do you know about that? No, I think what is depressing in a sense is that we feel the need to proscribe, you know, days when children would go and, you know, feast on this cultural sustenance. It should be part of the education, getting out there into the world, seeing these things for real. And I was like, bravo to what Kiara was saying, because it really bugs me when there is this thing, this notion that kids have a super short attention span and they need a screen or they need to hit a lever to make something interesting. Actually, they have a far, far greater, literally a far greater capacity to absorb information of any number of different types and from any number of different sources than we do as older people. And they can tackle this stuff. It's the same way that we've grown increasingly fearful of letting, you know, even older students wrestle with some very profound questions. Oh, well, you know, remove this from the syllabus altogether. Let people have a bash. Let kids go and look at this stuff. They don't need to be talked down to literally or metaphorically. Having said all of that, if this just prompts everyone to say, what is our collective cultural wealth? How do we share it more equitably and get kids engaged with it? That can only be a really profoundly good thing. So I worry sometimes about some of the dialogue around it, but at its heart, it's something very positive. So I welcome it broadly.
And Chiara, do you think, well, I guess, where do you draw the limits of what kids are going to be allowed to get away with here as saying, like, this is a profound cultural experience which I want to be able to include on my bucket list and tick off and receive due credit for?
The kids are picking.
Well, I think that is kind of the idea. And I think basically they kind of should, because otherwise you do just get that thing. And I have, I'm sure, at various points in my upbringing, been that bored school child being made to sit through something in which I just clearly was never going to be interested.
No, I mean, I made the joke, but in you know, accordance with what I just said, I do think that they should be able to pick and that they shouldn't just be taken to the British Museum 20 times in a row just because it's the most kind of officially sounding place in London. I don't know. I mean, I remember as one of my best school trips when I was a kid, a trip to Tunisia, which was meant to be visiting. Yeah, we were taken
nice.
To Tunisia. We were taken to Tunisia on a school trip, a cultural school trip to see.
I hadn't realised you were so fancy.
Of course. Can you not tell from my Italian accent? No, we were taken to see the ancient theatres, the ancient ruins in Tunisia. But we also spent the vast majority of the time on the beach, obviously. We were teenagers at the time. And yet, I remember it's one of the best cultural trips that I've done with my, you know, peers. Yes, because we were excited about going to the beach. But I remember the places too. So, you know, if the kids will put on their bucket list going to Brighton Pier, then if they'll be able to kind of be, I don't know, shepherded around and discover something about Brighton in the meantime, then why not?
Brighton Pier would have seemed the stuff of a madman's dreams at the schools I went to.
I was going to say, a trip to Tunisia knocks going to look at some crap Watling Daub hut in Essex into a cocked hat.
I don't know what the budget for this thing is. If you're in the UK, I mean, I could say Machu Picchu. Of course I want to go to Machu Picchu. I'm just thinking about school budgets here.
I think we once got to do a bus trip to the theme park of Old Sydney Town, where various unemployable actors dressed up like it was still the 19th century. You've got to go to Tunisia.
Listen, if they told me you can go to Sydney and look at actors dressed like, I don't know, whatever time it was, then I probably would have been quite attracted to my proposition.
You've got to understand that Old Sydney Town, if you're already in Sydney Town, is less
it's
exciting.
All relative, Andrew.
Easy for you to say. Tom, did your school lay on foreign holidays as well? Or?
It wasn't so many jollies as that. There's one very ill-fated later skiing trip, but that wasn't for the, you know, cultural illumination. No, lots of domestic... Listen, I visited lots of kind of, you know, the classic perennials. Stately homes, Hatfield House, the big museums of London. You're very lucky. If you grow up in London town, this stuff is almost literally on your doorstep. So, you know, I was in Highgate. I could just wander down to Highgate Cemetery and witness the famous communist plot, Karl Marx's grave, etc., etc. But this kind of stuff, you just kind of strolled past it. And I think that is, again, a unique cultural advantage, amazing social and cultural capital from being in a capital city. And again, is part of this maybe making it a bit joined up, getting some kids who are out in maybe rural areas that don't have such wealth so adjacent, make it a bit more accessible. And maybe digital plays a little bit of a role in that. That's still pretty good.
And finally, and those words are, in this instance, uttered with a specially solemn portent of what such a fanfare traditionally signifies, we return to Japan, where, it turns out, a local prefecture, wearied of being plagued by bear attacks, has commissioned, for reasons surpassing understanding, a pair of elderly musicians to write and record a rock song of sorts, with which to remind the public of the dangers of interaction with ursine interlopers. And yes, I saw ursine interlopers on the second stage at Glastonbury in 1995, etc. The song goes like this. Yeah, that is Black Bears Rock and Roll. I don't even know where to start. Tom, if you would like to talk amongst yourself, I'm just going to look up the lyrics here for the further enlightenment of our listeners.
I mean, to me, that sounds a bit like some kind of, I don't know, I'm thinking like Laurel Canyon, early 70s, Andrew, no? I was kind of into it. I don't know if that's the idea.
It's been a long week. The lyrics translate as, among other things, discard that naive way of thinking. Nearby that cub is a parent bear and it'll suddenly attack you. Roar, 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 roar. I think it's the right number of roars. It'll suddenly attack you. I said they've doubled back on the refrain there. That is a good device. cunning structure. Never turn your back and run away, and trying to play dead doesn't work, apparently.
Listen, that's useful information. I don't know. So I was under the impression that the song would actually frighten away the bear. I don't know if I, as a bear...
It might.
Scare the Jesus out of Andrew.
But you know, it wasn't that long ago that I learnt about the appropriate conduct to have in front of a bear. So if I were a Japanese child, perhaps that would be my first.
It tells you what not to do. It doesn't tell you what to actually do. This is useless advice. I am reminded of
you
the
ought not to. You don't run away. You stare at a bear, confront your fears, and slowly back away.
I am reminded at this time, going back to interactions with Australian wildlife, of what I still think is the worst or most useless advice I've ever been given. I was once solemnly told that crocodiles, the Australian crocodile, while the muscles that close its jaw are obviously so strong they can snap a human's leg off, the muscles that open its jaw are extremely weak. So the thing to do, I was earnestly told by somebody who thought this was useful advice, you simply hold its mouth closed. To which my next question was, yeah, and now what?
Very good point.
I've got like, you know, 3 meters of enraged Paleolithic megadeth, like clutched in my fist. What is my next move at this point?
I've got the first pressing of their original album as well. Can I just say that actually more bear attacks happen stateside in the US? So because I'm a professional broadcaster, I went online and did a bit of research, and I consulted the annals of the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Department. What music should you play to scare away a bear? Apparently, music doesn't bother them, Andrew. But they have quite a profound version, and I promise you, I'm not making this up, to talk radio.
No!
So if they're tuning in right now...
Well, they wouldn't
be. Just have the Monocle Daily playing. They'll be miles away.
So our advice is, if attacked by a bear, tune into Monocle 24. What if it's during the music hours?
Then you can also deploy an air horn. I like to say I give people lots of options to choose from.
We have been giving some thought ourselves to auctions. That's a whole other story. To options. I think, Chiara, we may have bought into the idea that this music was intended as bear repellent. And you came up with a song which you think might well work on that front, even though, as Tom has learned, it clearly isn't going to, because bears don't care. But they might care about this. What is this and why did you pick it?
Well, listen, I have to make... I have to admit something here. First of all, I really like this song, which is the first admission. Second of all, I did take this as a bit of an opportunity to think about the bear as a bit of a metaphor. And I think in terms of, you know, the friendliness of a bear, that the first person that came to mind was you, Andrew.
Obviously,
so,
thank you.
In my research for something that would scare off the bear, I kind of pictured you in my mind's eye. And I think that this is a song by Elettra Lamborghini called Pem Pem that would most legitimately make you run a mile. I hope you don't just leave the mic unattended now and literally leave the studio. But let's see what happens.
I am on the starting blocks.
Yo sé que es así, yo sé que él no me ama. Solo en la noche me llama, me invita a su casa. Quiere fumar marihuana, quiere llevarme a su cama. Quiere ser pen, pen, pere, pen, pen, pen. Pen, pere, pen, pen, pen. Quiere ser pen, pen, pere, pen, pen, pen.
I mean, I guess it could be argued that while playing that song at a bear would not actually work, if you were listening to that song anyway, then is being actually eaten by the bear
like the worst thing that's
of the available options? I mean, you'd take it. I did pick a tune myself. I thought I would. I know of a song or knew of a song which does kind of try to see the human versus bear contretemps from the point of view of the bear. And happily, it is written by one of my very favourite ever songwriters of all time ever, Paul Westerberg, best known for his work with The Replacements, with whom I'm sure you're all extremely familiar. Mm-hmm. But he wrote this song for the soundtrack of Open Season. Paul Westerberg, this will appeal to you, Tom. He is a man who throughout his career does like a pun.
Go on.
Or a wordplay. This isn't really a pun. It is more just your juxtaposition, your wordplay. The song is called The Right to Arm Bears.
Who got it? Who's got it? We got it! It's your right to arm bears. It's your right to arm bears. Oh, my dear, let's show them some fear.
There's plenty more where that came from.
Andrew, have we stumbled on something here? Was it a transcription error and the founding fathers were actually very, very clear in what they meant, and we've had a few hundred years of pretty bad misunderstandings, and that's what they were getting at all along? Could this be the moment we realise?
You think amidst their earnest deliberations about how to most effectively distribute power in the republic they were founding, somebody said, I think it's really important that we give guns to bears.
Well, you know, an early ecological viewpoint, perhaps. I don't know, Andrew. I'm just throwing it out there.
Funnier things have happened. I was just reminded by our producer that it is, in fact, Fat Bear Week. Where? I can't read what you sent me, Carlotta. It's disappeared from the screen.
Specifically fat bears.
It is Fat Bear Week in Alaska. It is Fat Bear Week in Alaska.
What goes on there?
I really feel for the slim bears.
I'm having yelled in my ear that you can apparently go online and vote for your favourite fat bear or whichever bear you think is the fattest. It's a thing. Kiara, Slim Bear Week might be next week, or maybe it was last week. I assume there is one. On that note, I fear we have deviated from the point somewhat. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Kiara Ramella and Tom Edwards, also to Monocle's Fiona Wilson in Tokyo. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Miller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Happy Fat Bear Week, and have a great weekend.